Okay, so last time we were talking about the nature of light, which I think is one of the truly great victories of modern science and modern physics, understanding the nature of light. And I'm good. Yeah, I think I'm good. Thanks. So James Clerk Maxwell is the person who pulled all of this together. Lots of work had been done on electric fields and magnetic fields, and there was some understanding that there had to be a deep relationship between them because of the fact that the things we saw in demos last time, if you have a moving charge, it actually has a magnetic field, will exert a force on it. So in the case of the example we looked at, we had a wire, and we put a current through it, which basically is moving charge, and if it was in a magnetic field, it would jump. If you have a compass needle, which is sensitive to magnetic fields, outside of a current-carrying wire, it will react. So there's a magnetic field outside of a current-carrying wire, but not a wire where the charge is static. So there's clearly something strange going on, which, in fact, Albert Einstein ended up solving completely. But Maxwell took a huge step toward understanding the relationship between electric and magnetic fields, and he came up with something called Maxwell's equations. And I basically am just showing them to you because it's good to have seen them, and you're going to see some physics major geeks walking around with them on a t-shirt, and God said, and then there'll be the equations there. So next time you'll know what it is, and you can go, Just look at them and let's see. You should say, shouldn't that be H instead of B or something like that, and see what they do. At any rate, how would they change if there were magnetic monopoles? That would be a good thing to ask them, see what they do. At any rate, these equations are an example of something that most physicists consider very beautiful. So there's sort of this conversation that happens among physicists that verges on metaphysics or philosophy, where you sort of wonder, wow, why is it that beautiful mathematics seems to be the way the world works? And I don't know the answer to that. But within these equations, there happens to be a lot of information. And there are a couple of very major conclusions that come out of them that basically Maxwell came up with. I mean, there was a lot of input that Maxwell used to build these equations that basically described a lot of the kinds of things we were seeing last time. But once he had these equations together, he was able to synthesize sort of a new understanding, and he learned some very important things. So one of the things that pops out of these equations is that the electric field and the magnetic field are quite intimately related, and in fact, out of these equations, you find that the electric and magnetic fields both satisfy wave equations. We call them coupled wave equations, which means if you have a B that's changing, it will create or it will induce an electric field that will change, and so Maxwell's equations in physics language are always true, but exactly what the solution looks like to Maxwell's equations depends on the situation that you put it in. And what they tell you is that if you have, for example, a changing electric field, and the example I use, if I have a fistful of charge and I move it, I'm clearly going to have a changing electric field in the space around it, because as the fist moves, the distance from the fist and the charge to, say, some point P out here will change, which means the electric field has to be changing as a function of time. And Maxwell's equations then tell you if you have a changing electric field, it will actually induce a changing magnetic field, and then Maxwell's equations also tell you, gee, if I have a changing magnetic field, it will induce a changing electric field. And so these things are quite circular. And it's an interesting set of coupled equations. They basically feed into each other. So once you create it, it just happens. And so the field, the E field creates a B field, which creates an E field, which creates a B field, and this phenomenon will propagate out at the speed of light. First of all, both the E field and the B field will satisfy wave equations very similar to what you would have for mechanical waves if you were to mathematically analyze them, and they're coupled together, so one induces the other. And you can analyze the speed at which this wave propagates in a vacuum, and you find that it gives you exactly the speed of light. So I have a quote, I think, in the book that you've got, that of course I'm ditzing on now, but effectively Maxwell says, you know, we're sort of led to the conclusion that this is light. And so then you can really analyze in detail what Maxwell's equations tell you about the nature of light. And it turns out that, in fact, we do believe light is a wave. So a lot of baggage comes with that. One of the things is that we can use Maxwell's equations to basically derive the laws of optics and to understand the nature of light. So one of the things we talked about last time was that light in and of itself, the way we usually refer to it, we're thinking of visible light, but within Maxwell's equations, if I have a wave on a string, for example, I can wiggle it really fast and I can have a short wavelength propagating along the string, or I can do it very slowly. And within Maxwell's equations, they don't care whether this oscillation is fast or slow. So there's no limit within this theory that says that, oh, you can only have this weird phenomenon within some range. And in fact, it's not limited. We can have it as big as the universe and as small as we can possibly ever go, however small that happens to be. So there's a broad range of this phenomenon, which we call electromagnetic waves because of this coupling between the electric fields and the magnetic fields, which all of a sudden, again, with Maxwell's equations, I think, sort of go from this realm of something we sort of pulled out of thin air to model these things we see in the lab with electric and magnetic phenomena into something that has a bit more reality to it, because we had talked about electric fields and magnetic fields as a manifestation of whatever it is that has electric charge, or however the magnetic thing is formed, a magnet, what it is they do to the space which conveys the force to some little magnet or another charge out there. So it's truly just a way of looking at it that seemed to be productive. And people then developed this mathematical infrastructure around it in describing it. And now all of a sudden you find with Maxwell's equations, it really doesn't say anything about charge. And it doesn't say anything much about a magnet. It's E and B fields and what they do when they're together. I mean, so all of a sudden, this strange thing that people pulled out of thin air seems to be real, which I think is pretty cool. This whole, you would never have imagined this phenomenon of light when you first were making up this idea of an electric field or a magnetic field. So it's an example where the sort of the blundering mathematical formalism of science and physics in particular can sort of stumble into new and really cool and different phenomena that you really couldn't have imagined otherwise. And I don't know quite how to describe it, but it's part of the magic that makes the scientific methodology work. It's not really that people set out to do a lot of the stuff that happens. Most of the really cool things that have been discovered quite by accident. And you'll see some other examples this semester. Sometimes people do set out to discover something, but more often than not, the great advances are made by complete surprise. And I think this is actually one example. So visible light is a thin little window in terms of the wavelength in meters. And remember, 10 to the minus 6 meters, that's a micron or a micrometer. A hair is about 100 of those or so, 100, 150, depending on the thickness of your hair. microwaves are about the size, they range from the size of a baseball down to something something sort of microscopic almost. Radio waves are really quite big. And then gamma rays are even smaller than atoms and nuclei. So a broad range. And the light of the different frequencies will interact with matter in different ways, which is actually makes it very rich. It also gives us a way of probing matter in different ways and learning different things about processes in the universe or in the matter right around us. So this variety is really very rich and a very good thing. So I was mentioning briefly about this deep relationship between relativity and between electric fields and magnetic fields. And so, and in fact, that was what led Einstein to special relativity. And this is a little cutout of the first of his paper on special relativity. And my German is long ago in the past, but that says at the top of the page on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. It doesn't say on the relativity of time and space, which is sort of how we think about it. It was on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. So that was really the core of what was bothering Einstein, was this how to understand electric and magnetic fields. And he's known to have asked, for example, if I could run at the speed of light, what would light look like? Which is a pretty good question. I don't think I have an answer. But to give you a sense of why this, it's pretty obvious that you have to have relativity become part of electricity and magnetism, let's look at one example. Last time in class, I had a demo where we had two wires, okay? And I put current through the two wires, and there was a force between them. Now, when I say I put current, the way to think about it is the wire is made up of a lot of positive nuclei, and when I put current, I effectively put an electric field such that the electrons that are in the wire, some of them are free to move because it's a conducting material, and basically the electrons are able to move. So what will happen is that the net charge stays the same, and each centimeter of this wire, I don't create a positive or negative charge. I'm just simply taking the negative charge and moving it. So it basically moves from one positive source to another as it goes up. So the net electric charge doesn't change. All I've done is create a current through here, or moving charge. So let's think about that for a moment. The way that I interpreted it for you, when you see that in the lab, is we had the example where I had current in a single wire over here, and when I did, I was a compass down beneath it, and the compass moved. So if I put current in a wire, I get a compass move. That tells you there's a magnetic field in this wire. Then we did a demo where I put a current through a wire, and it happens to be sitting in a magnetic field, and it had a force on it. So the way to interpret this experiment when I have the two wires is that if I put current through this wire, it creates a magnetic field in the space around it, and this is a current-carrying wire in that magnetic field, and it will feel a force, and vice versa. And that's what causes the force between these two wires. And so this is a classical pre-Maxwell analysis of the force between these two wires. And a physicist would look at that and say it's because of the magnetic field. It's the magnetic force, actually, that's causing this thing. Okay. So I'm going to oversimplify just a little, but let's think about it. I have two charges, two positive charges sitting here in space at rest with respect to you. What is the nature of the force between them? It will repel. Why? They're both positive. But how would you phrase, what would you call the nature of that force? I mean, what kind of force is it? Electric. It's electric. It's Coulomb's force. I mean, when we describe it, it's the force between two static charges. And so we would describe that as an electric force. Okay? Now, I have the two charges, and I run really fast past you. Now what do you see? Yeah, you now see a moving charge, which is what a physicist calls a current, which is just like what we saw over here, and we interpret it as a magnetic force between these two things. Now, I do still have a net charge, but you can construct the example such that I don't, at any rate. So, if we have a plus charge and a plus charge at rest, then the force between these is electric. And if we are running at some velocity this way, then we'll actually see these charges moving with some velocity if we go running past it or if they're moving past us. And now we would see them as currents, and we would interpret it as a magnetic force. And again, you get into one of these strange situations. Who's right? I mean, what has changed? Nothing has happened to the charges. All that's happened is that you have looked at it at rest with respect to the charges, and then you looked at it running past them, if you want to think of it that way. I could say they run past you, but that doesn't matter. That's just a point of view thing. And yet what we see as the cause of the force in one case is electric charge, electric force, and in the other case is magnetic force. So it's just a point of view thing. So clearly, as you change your reference frame, what you think of as an electric field in one reference frame and a magnetic field has to get all mixed up. And so that's the problem Einstein solved. Maxwell didn't solve that problem. Yes?
So you're calling that a magnetic force because when the current runs through it, it creates a magnetic field around it?
Yeah. So if this is a current, it creates a magnetic field around it, and a moving charge and a magnetic field will actually feel a force, and vice versa. So that's the nature of the force between those. And you could call me on the fact that I still have a net electric charge here and a net electric charge there, but I can set up the problem so that I have basically a tube of positive and negative charges that is net neutral, and then you go running in a certain direction and you'll get length contraction. It'll turn out I can set it up so that isn't a problem. So I'm glossing over that a little bit because I didn't want to drag you through the mud. But that's the basic idea. Here, they're at rest. It's just an electric force. Here, you would interpret it as a magnetic force. But you haven't done anything to them. All you've done is move. So there's clearly a very deep relationship between electricity and magnetism that depends on your point of view, which is pretty strange. And that is what motivated Einstein to do special relativity. And sure enough, as we've seen, space and time change as you change your point of view. Electric and magnetic fields also transform or change from one point of view to another. So if I have a physical situation where I have an electric field this way and a magnetic field that way, and I'm at rest with respect to them, and I then come running past at a high velocity, I may see something completely different in terms of the electric and magnetic fields. And relativity allows you to transform what you see in one reference frame to the other, just like you do with space and time. So it's pretty strange stuff. Any comments or questions on? Yes?
I'm not sure if this is necessarily important, but do you think Einstein had easier time figuring out or understanding the significance of the technology at the time?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I'm of two minds on that. On the one hand, Einstein was one of these physicists who just did these thought experiments. I mean, he wasn't a laboratory guy. He had a way of making these, of taking these ideas and constructing these, he called them thought experiments, basically. And so we did one with the little train, and out of this he was able to infer amazing things. And was it independent of what was going on at the time? And I'd have to say not at all. In fact, we sort of treat relativity as if it were entirely pulled out of thin air. But in fact, people already had thought their way through some elements of this. They just didn't quite get it yet. They hadn't pulled it together. The transformations for space and time from one reference frame to another, when I showed them to you, those four equations, we don't actually call them the Einstein transformations. We call them the Lorentz transformations. They had been discovered before Einstein. But in fact, they had this weird idea, and now I'm going to get on thin ice because I'm not a historical expert on what was happening at the time. But from what I had read, I believe that Lorentz had discovered this, and he knew about length contraction. And there was this idea that, in fact, if something moved very fast, that space itself actually did contract. And they were trying to, they didn't understand why this thing seemed to happen, but they understood the math said it had to happen. And it was Einstein who threw in the constancy of the speed of light and then basically came up with this idea, well, it does happen, but it also happens the other way, and it's all relative. And so all of a sudden, everything becomes clear once he got on the problem. But I think with many big scientific advances, and I think this one included, you get to a point where there's a certain amount of knowledge and the concept is right to be picked, I guess. And Einstein was really good at picking them. General relativity, I feel a little bit more like he really pulled that one out of thin air. I mean, I don't... There was, to my knowledge, nothing compelling that would drive you to that. But I think relativity was not far from being discovered by somebody. It was right there. Technologically, I mean, there were certain pieces that had to come in place. I mean, people had to measure the speed of light and do these spectroscopic experiments in order to talk about how the speed of light seemed to not care what direction we're going, even though we're on a very, you know, fast moving object. And of course, technology helped people really believe in Maxwell's theory, so there was certainly a lot of confidence in our understanding of electromagnetic theory at the time. So I don't know if that helps. That's sort of... The distinction between them. Yeah, that's a good question. I guess to me, and this isn't because I know anything about it historically, but I think they were thought of as separate beasts to begin with because they're manifested as different things in the world around us. And it takes a bit of a deeper look to begin to think they have to have a deep relationship. That's when you notice that a current carrying wire jumps in a magnetic field or something. The history of that... probably is pretty well known, actually, because the a changing magnetic field inducing a current is called Faraday's law of induction, and I mean there are particular names who did work which contributed toward our understanding of electromagnetic fields becoming less distinct in our minds. But when were they first thought of as distinct? I mean, the first person who looks at a magnet must have thought of it as a magnetic force relative to when they did laundry in the cave and found static cling. I mean, I don't know. Those seem like very different things. So naively, I would think of those as very different. It takes a bit of a careful experiment to begin to see that they're intimately related. I mean, I guess it's conceivable if you had a little magnet and there was a bolt of lightning nearby, you'd see it jump. but you'd probably be so scared you wouldn't have noticed. Everything was jumping at that point. I don't know. All right, so light is a wave. Maxwell tells us very, very clearly that light is a wave. And waves have very particular characteristics. And I wanted to do a little bit more with waves and pound on this point just a little bit. Okay. I have an example here of something which can show us sort of mechanical wave. Remember that we talked about a wave being basically a vibration of something that's periodic. And it takes more than that, though, because there has to be a connection between the things that are vibrating. You have a question? No, okay. Yeah. And so the example we used was if you were all standing up randomly doing this, it didn't look like a wave. But if there was something that tied you together, either because of timing and you wanted to make a stadium wave, or when I did it as I was walking in front of you, then all of a sudden with that timing, you got a nice wave. Okay, so that's a mechanical wave. Here, what I have are a series of rods that are tied to a wire that goes from one rod to the other all the way across. Here the rods are long and heavy. Here they're shorter and lighter. Okay? And if I hold this, these things are free to move up and down. Alright? If I move one of them up or down, so for example, if I move this one up, note that it doesn't go alone because it's connected to this wire. And if I have a wire and I twist it here, it actually twists over here a little bit too. So if I twist it on one end by moving this, it also pulls up some of these. And so now you can see what's going to happen. If I create a wave, it just goes. Are you able to see this? So it's an example of a mechanical wave, right? And if we wanted to describe this mathematically, one can, and you get, so light actually would be described by the same way. Now I wanted to show you something sort of interesting here though. Look what happens when I have a wave here that hits this boundary between these two different size bars, which is broken right here. Okay, so you go from short bars to heavy bars, but the wire between that holds them together is the same. So look, watch the wave, and then watch it when it goes over there. What do you notice? What did you see? Slows down a lot.
The amplitude is slower also.
Yeah. So it slows down a whole lot, okay? Let's see if I can. There you have the slow going and then all of a sudden, whoom. Okay? So what's changing here is that the mass of the thing that's oscillating is changing. Or the way you might think about it, as a physicist would say, the medium is changing. What is oscillating is actually changing. And so for the same wave, you go and all of a sudden, this wants to move up, but it takes more time because remember that F equals ma, so the acceleration I get here for a given force is less if it's heavy. So it takes more time for this thing to move. And that ends up slowing the wave down. And all that's changed is the medium of the wave. Okay? The same is true for sound and any other wave that you have. It's just a little bit hard to see because you have to have these boundaries in the medium. It turns out that hot air and cool air have a different density per unit volume, different amount of mass per unit volume, and it will actually cause a change in the speed of sound, for example. The same thing happens with light because light is a wave. And before I show you, let me show you what the result of that is. It's hard to draw, so I'm going to try to do it with this Java applet that somebody made. Let's imagine a wave of light is incident on diamond. Light is a wave, so if we are able to stand off to the side and we have light coming in this direction, and there's diamond here and air here, diamond is different from air, so the medium is different that the light is traveling through. Whatever that means, and we'll talk about it in a second. Think of as if you were able to visualize, just like this were a water wave, you could imagine each crest being separated by a certain amount, right? And let's imagine we're looking at the crests of the electric field as this light wave is hitting this boundary. The speed of light in a vacuum or in air is fixed, and so all of these waves go at the same speed. And it turns out, just like we have over here, if you go through a medium that's heavier, say in glass or diamond or something, the light actually slows down. And what does that do to the light? At the boundary itself, this point has to be joined to both the wave in the diamond and the wave in the air. So it's the same for both. But if this wave is going slower than that wave, the only way you can preserve that condition is to have this wave moving at an angle with respect to that wave. Can you see that visually? And the other thing is the wavelength has changed in the material. Did that make sense? The speed here and the speed here is different. And yet at the boundary, they have to stay connected. And so the only way to do that is to have this wavelength actually be shorter than that and to have an angle, the bending happen right here. That's what's known as refraction. Yes?
Intuitively, I understand the bending, but why does the wavelength in this situation...
Why does the wavelength change?
I just don't see where the wavelength is or
how. Oh, okay. So the wavelength would be the distance between the two crests. And we're picturing each of these lines as, say, being a crest in the electric field coming in. So you have successive waves, if you want, sort of coming in, and the distance between these is one wavelength. And so the wavelength here is shorter. So when it comes to light, we quantify this with a quantity called the index of refraction. The index of refraction is equal to the velocity of light in a vacuum divided by the velocity of the light in the material. And this tends to be, that means greater than 1. So in the case of diamond, for example, it's actually quite high. It's over 2. In the case of air, it's more or less almost 1. For water, it's 1.33. For some glasses, it's 1.5. We're not going to get too hung up on the index of refraction. I guess I'm writing on this thing, but I'm not actually showing you what I'm writing. So this is called the index of refraction. And all I'm really wanting to tell you is that different media, the wave propagation properties will depend on different media, which you see here. And in the case of light, that will lead to a bending at a medium. Actually, that's true for all mechanical waves, but it's particularly present for light. And this turns out to be a very important phenomenon. So, for example, if I have a ray of light incident onto glass, a glass interface, for example, just like what you saw in that demo, it gets bent. Like so. And so you could imagine it turns out that if the light is going the other way, if it's going inside glass, if we look at this 90 degree line, if you're going from a low index of refraction to a higher index of refraction, this thing gets bent a bit toward this 90 degree line, 90 degrees to the interface. If you're going from the high index of refraction to low, it's bent the other way. And so what will happen if I have glass that's shaped like this, as light comes through, it's bent this way, and then when it hits the other interface, it's actually bent away from that 90 degree line, so it's bent more like that. So if you were to take glass and make it in this sort of shape, and you take rays of light, they'll be bent like that. And that's how a lens works, and it's all based on refraction. So I can show you an example, or many examples, with frosted glass. So let's suppose if I have beams of laser light passing through glass, and they hit the glass at an interface right here that's flat, so it'd be like a pane of glass on a window or something, then they just go straight through. But if they hit at an angle, you can see this one hits at an angle and it gets bent. Okay, that's a phenomenon of refraction. If I have a lens, so this would be the shape of a lens if you were farsighted, it would actually bend the light like so. So if you wanted to cook an ant, right, this is a magnifying glass lens. And so you can see that because the glass is shaped like I have on the bottom there, the one ray up top is bent toward the center, and the ray on the bottom is bent toward the center, but the ray that sort of hits the glass square on, and it's not at an angle, goes straight through. So this is known as refraction. And you can derive this. You can derive the laws of optics that govern how these rays are bent from Maxwell's equations. Okay, so it's an example of the fact that light is a wave. Any comments or questions about this demo? Yes.
I don't understand why that shape comes in all sorts of
Okay. So let's pretend I have a magnifying glass lens. And now I have a ray of I have rays of light coming parallel. So let's say I have one up here, one here, and one here. The 90 degree line when this one hits is like this. So it gets bent at this interface toward the 90 degree line. And then when it goes, it goes straight through the glass and it hits now here, but now you're going from a high index of refraction to a low index of refraction, and it will actually be bent away from that line, so it gets bent straight down. This ray basically is hitting a flat surface, so it just goes straight through, and it hits another flat surface and it goes straight through. And this ray, the 90 degree line is here, so it's actually bent a little bit this way, and then the 90 degree line is like that, and it gets bent more that way. So that's how that shape causes the rays to converge. The trick is the fact that the light is traveling at different speeds in the material. I don't really want to get hung up on this analytically. I mean, there's a law that we would use called Snell's law that you can describe this and get into it in detail, but basically, the light will get bent at an interface if it's at an angle, and it gets bent a certain direction if it's going from high index of refraction to low. That is, if it's going from a place where it's traveling fast to a place where it travels slower, and it gets bent the other way if it's going from slow to fast. Yes?
Are you going to calculate this for our exam?
No. You're not. No. What I'm really trying to do is to just show you that light exhibits refraction. So I'm talking about what refraction is. And it's, if I have the lens shaped differently, so it's like this. Oh, sorry. Put it in blinding me. If it's shaped like that, then the light is bent out. Like so. All right. So if you're nearsighted, in fact, that's what your glasses lenses are doing to the light. And you'll find if you're nearsighted, your lens is thinner in the middle than it is on the outside if you wear glasses. If you're farsighted, it's thicker in the middle than it is on the outside. So the fact that light exhibits refraction is a statement that light is a wave. Okay, just like we saw earlier with the water, where water waves interfere with one another, the same is true for light. We saw that with the laser, so that's another example of light being a wave. And light will also exhibit interference in the form of beats, but the example for this is better that I give it to you in terms of sound. We talked about it a little bit last time. Okay, so I have two tuning forks in boxes so you can listen to them nicely. Okay, so the pitch is basically supposed to be the same. Now I'm going to do them at the same... Well, let's see what happens if I do them at the same time. Now, they're probably not perfectly the same, so I'm not. You may hear something strange here. You hear the intensity going up and down a little bit? That's the phenomenon of beats, which we talked about last time, where if you have two waves of slightly different frequencies, when they interfere, you'll get periods where they cancel each other out and periods where they add together. And so this is we call beats, and the closer they are in frequency, the slower this modulation is of the intensity. So in this case, they're pretty close in frequency. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to detune one of these. I'm going to change its frequency a little bit by putting a weight on a piece of the tuning fork. And let's see what we hear now. because now the frequency should be a bit more different. So this modulation should happen faster. And if I put it a little higher so that it's even worse, now it's happening so fast you can barely hear it. So I'll go somewhere in the middle. Okay, so this is what you can use to tune a piano or, yeah?
I just have a question about refraction. If the medium is like dense enough, or, yeah, I guess dense enough, could it ever refract like along that 90-degree angle?
That's a good question, actually. It's when it's coming out. So if you are inside of glass, so if you have a ray of light that is inside glass and it's going into air, like so, it gets bent away from this 90-degree angle, so it gets bent like that. So there comes an angle as you have this incident ray coming at a steeper and steeper angle where it will actually be bent exactly along that interface. In other words, it doesn't come out. So what happens is that if you have a light, say for example underwater, and you look at that light coming out into the air, it will only come out to a certain radius, and outside of that, that light is internally reflected into the water. It's sort of cool. That particular angle we call the critical angle. But okay, so all of this was really just to try to convince you that light is a wave. There's no question about it. Okay? Maxwell's equations are wave equations. They describe light well. You can derive all of the stuff that I've shown you for light and look at it in the lab, and it works. Light interferes. It refracts. It shows interference, just like any other mechanical wave does. The weird thing about light is that it travels in a vacuum. This doesn't work in a vacuum. You don't have these rods in a vacuum. Air is a vibration of air molecules, by definition, not a vacuum. Water waves are in water, by definition, not a vacuum. String waves are on a string. You have to have a string. So every other type of wave is a mechanical wave. But this whole weird thing with light, it involves electric and magnetic fields. And that can happen in a vacuum, which is a really good thing because, of course, we get all our energy from the sun, and the light has to travel through a lot of vacuum to get here. So that's sort of the weirdness with light. But it is clearly a wave phenomenon, and everybody's pretty happy with that. So you're okay with that? All right. So then, people got pretty cocky about our understanding of the universe because we had Newton, who had explained gravity very well, and we hadn't had Einstein yet, but we didn't know anything was really wrong with gravity yet. Wave-like phenomena, light was well understood. So people were then trying to understand light and its interaction with matter, and to try to understand more about the structure of matter and to see what we could learn about light through that. So there's a guy named Max Planck who came along, and when he was young, in fact, he was discouraged from even going into physics. Well, initially he wanted to be a musician, and he asked the musician, what does it take to do that? And the musician basically said, if you have to ask, then it's not for you. And then he went and talked to the physicist, and the physicist said, well, physics is basically solved, so you probably ought not to go into it. So it was a weird sort of time in that way. But there were only a few problems that weren't really pretty well understood that people were working on. And if you wanted to understand how light interacts with matter, then maybe the easiest place to start would be to understand the glow of an object and how it changes with temperature. So most of the light that you see coming from that lectern is reflected light. It has really nothing much to do with the lectern. I mean, it may be some is absorbed and some may be re-emitted, but a lot of it just basically bounces off of it, okay? But if we were able to shut off all ambient light, in fact, the lectern has a glow. You might not see it very well. In fact, it turns out for things to glow well in the visible light range, you have to have them be pretty hot. So the example that usually comes to mind for me is just a stovetop element. If you have one of those wire elements on your stove, you know, when you turn it up and it's coming on, it looks dark. It's starting to feel hot, but it still looks dark. And then it goes from this really deep red that you can barely see into glowing into a much brighter red. And when it's really hot, it's sort of almost whitish. You with me? Or if you play with the fire and you stick a poker in a fire, right? When it's so hot, it's sort of glowing red. But when you really get it in the hottest part of the fire, it sort of glows whitish and bluish, okay? So this is, I mean, people understand this now, or now they do. That is what you might imagine you want to study. You want to study how things glow in order to try to understand the interaction of matter with light. So physicists call that light that comes from a glow, they call it black body radiation. And the reason it's radiation, let me use that word a little bit. In electromagnetism, this wave, this light wave phenomenon, this electromagnetic stuff, we actually call radiation, electromagnetic radiation. In everyday life around us, radiation means more than that because it's a bit of a broader term because we get mixed up with particles and nuclei and, you know, things. But to a physicist, if you call it electromagnetic radiation, you basically just mean light. You may mean all these different frequencies, but you just mean light. So that's all I'm talking about now. And we're going to get to the other types of particles later on in the term. But black body radiation is basically just saying, give me that component of the light coming from an object which is emitted by that object, not reflected. So in order to see that, the way to do it is to take the object and put it in a black box, a totally opaque cavity, and put a little dot, a little pinhole in that cavity, and look through the pinhole. And then you look at the light that comes through that pinhole, and that, you could argue, is what is coming from the glow of this object. So you can do an experiment where you heat the object up inside that cavity, and then you look at the light that's coming from that object. And you can plot the intensity of that light versus the frequency or the color of that light. And when you do, you get a weird shape like this. I guess I'm calling it wavelength here. So if you plot how much light you see as a function of the wavelength of the light, you'll get a weird sort of bell curve depending on the temperature. If you make this very, very hot, you'll get a much brighter light coming out. And the light will go to a lower frequency, a higher frequency or a shorter wavelength. So it gets bluer. If it's glowing at a lower temperature, it's sort of reddish. And so this fits what we already know. If you have the fireplace poker and it's sort of cool, it glows red. As you stick it into the hotter part of the fire, it glows whiter. And so this is an experiment that you can do to experimentally figure out how the light that's emitted from an object depends on its temperature. And this is known as the black body spectrum, and it's very characteristic. Every substance has it. You're glowing right now. This is glowing right now. It's just glowing at frequencies that you can't see. You glow more in the infrared. That's sort of, and that's too long a wavelength for your eye to see. But you heat things up to like 3,000 degrees, they glow quite nicely, right? So people knew a bit about matter. They knew it was made up of electric charges. And so they had these models of wiggling electric charges oscillating at a frequency that would create the light at certain frequencies. Right, this is a reasonable model of how light would interact with electric charges if you know all about Maxwell's equations. So when people did that, they would get curves that would like do this. And they were just wrong. So the very best physicists in the world, who knew the very most about Maxwell's equations and were phenomenal mathematicians, would take all the best assumptions in the world, and they could not describe something as simple as how much light of what color is emitted by an object that's glowing. It was a totally broken thing, and nobody knew what was wrong. So this was a serious problem. It was one of the few problems people had in physics that day. It was one of the few things that they didn't know how to solve. So that was the situation up until Max Planck came along in about, I didn't put the year on here. It was post-Maxwell's equations, so it was post-1860s. I think it was like 1880s to 1890, somewhere right in there, pre-Einstein. Max Planck came up with a formula, a mathematical formula, that perfectly described the black body radiation spectrum. Totally solved this problem that all these physicists have been trying and unable to solve. But the problem was that Max Planck, in order to derive that formula, made a completely wacky assumption. He assumed that light, instead of being a continuous wave, which we all know it is, he assumed that light comes in little packets. We say he assumed it was quantized. That instead of being a smooth wave, it would come in bits. And those bits had a very particular dependence. The energy of those bits had a very particular dependence on the color or the frequency. Planck assumed that the energy of each packet is equal to some constant, which he called H. We call H. Call it Planck's constant. It's just a number. Times the frequency of the light. So blue light has a higher frequency than red light. So this number is bigger, which means blue light has packets that have higher energy than red light, for example. And I misspelled Planck again. Yes, did you have a question?
So this is wrong? This is a wrong assumption?
Certainly was thought to be at the time.
Oh, no, but now it's right.
We're going to talk about that confusion as we go. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. And we're going to talk about the fact that it seems wrong or it seems right, depending on your point of view. Yeah. So Planck made this assumption. So you say, well, why did Planck assume that? Planck assumed that because with that, he was able to solve this problem. He was trying to figure out how to modify the model in order to solve this problem that he was working on. But we all know light is a wave, and you can't have packets of waves, right? If you're at the beach, where are the packets of the water waves? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, is this like the duality of light?
Yeah. So this assumption is completely wacky, given what everybody knew at the time. So people actually didn't believe in it. But they did have, and I won't bother dragging you through it, Planck came up with a very particular mathematical formula of which there was one parameter in it, which was this number, this constant H, which he was able to measure, or people could measure. Basically, by setting the scale of these, you could determine what H happens to be. And that formula didn't just sort of work, it worked and still does perfectly. It fits the data exactly at all different temperatures. So people looked at this and thought, okay, well, we now know the right formula. We just don't know how to get it, because how Planck did it is crazy. So that was really the prevailing attitude. Okay? Because light is a wave. So things stayed like that. I mean, things were like that for a while. Actually, they more or less were that way up until 1905. There was another phenomenon. Yes?
What do you mean packets of waves?
At this time, people thought that was just sort of nonsense.
No, what is it? What does that mean?
Just give me some time. We'll talk more. Okay? So there was another phenomenon which was called the photoelectric effect. And what the photoelectric effect was, suppose I had I have some sort of surface of a heavy metal. And by that I mean gold or tin or lead or something like that. And if I shine light on the surface, sometimes it will actually eject electrons off that surface. And so people studied. You could measure the electrons coming off basically as an electric current in your device that you're trying to measure. And so you study the number of electrons and the energy of the electrons as a function of the intensity and color of the light. And you might ask, oh, why would people do this? It's a way of trying to understand how light interacts with matter. And at this stage, I mean, there are stages of science where you sort of go out and look at whatever you can find. I mean, it's not so different from alchemy. You mix stuff together and see what smokes and what gets hot and what color it turns. And you keep track of all these observables, and then after a while you begin to find patterns, and this is partly how science progresses. And it was a little bit like this. It was like, well, let's see how light interacts with matter. And it was noticed that you shine light on heavy metals, you'll get electrons ejected off, and you could then measure the amount of current depending on how bright the light is and what color the light is, and you keep track of it. And so people came up with curves, not so different from what I was just showing, of how many electrons would come off with what energy as a function of color and intensity of the light. And I could show you the curves and we could talk about the details, but I think it's not worth our while. Let's just say that people were unable to, again, if you took the classical theory of light, it didn't fit what people saw at all. It was seriously broken. In 1905, Albert Einstein, in one of four papers that he published in 1905, of which two were on special relativity, and one was on something called the Brownian motion, which basically was the first direct experimental evidence of the existence of atoms. There was a lot of indirect stuff, but this was, Brownian motion is the description of the motion of things like pollen and oil, which if you look at through a microscope, they actually wiggle around. And to understand that wiggling, you actually have to have a statistical model of it being bashed around by the atoms in the oil. And Einstein actually derived this whole thing and basically could showed us that atoms, with the direct experimental evidence, that atoms had to exist. So that was also a huge paper. I mean, it was a hell of a year for Einstein. He sort of showed us atoms exist. He overthrew our entire concept of space and time, and he did this. Now, what this was Einstein came up with an explanation of the photoelectric effect that was able to explain all of the data. Again, in order for Einstein to do that, he assumed that light comes in little packets. And if you measured how the energy of those packets depends on the frequency of the light, you have that one constant in there, H, which Planck had. This is a totally different phenomenon. And if you go and you measure that constant of proportionality, it's the same. Now, light's a wave, okay? And then we have one wacko who shows us that you can assume light comes in little packets and it explains this phenomenon being black body radiation. Okay, cool accident. All right, now we have a formula. I don't know what this guy's smoking, but you know, we now have the formula. But I don't know that that means light comes in packets. Now you've got another guy who wasn't as well established, right? I mean, this was a big year for Einstein, but people didn't know who Einstein really was. And he explains yet another phenomenon with the same sort of assumption, and now you look at the actual description of the packets. The energy of the packet is equal to some constant times the frequency. And when you measure that constant with these totally independent things, you get the same number. Right? And so, overnight, all of a sudden light comes in little packets. And maybe this is a strange sort of analogy, but the one analogy that always comes to my mind was the day that 9/11 happened. I mean, I get this phone call, airplane hit the World Trade Center. I'm like, well, that's horrible. I mean, airplanes have hit buildings before. One hit the Empire State Building, so I thought, what a tragic accident. I, of course, assumed airplane was a little Piper Cub or something. And then the person that was on the other end, no, I think I saw some, I mean, I think it was a big plane from what they were saying. I'm like, oh, well, that's bad. And then while this person was on the phone, the second building was hit. And so it went from a tragic accident. The discussion was it a Piper Cub or a big plane? You know, big planes are, you know, how did that happen? Boy, that's sort of weird. To, holy shit, we've got this big terrorist thing going on, right? And it was that kind of, and so it's certainly an imperfect analogy and happier analogy, I like to think, that, you know, there was this completely wacky idea, and then you assume the same sort of thing. They're totally different, but now you get the same number, Planck's constant, and instantly you know, okay, you can no longer live in denial that light comes in little packets. Okay? And so that is the start of quantum theory.
What's light measured in, the packets of light?
I'm not even sure how to answer that. I mean, because what you're measuring depends on what you're looking at.
So it's not like...
I mean, Oh, well, yeah, the energy you would measure in joules or something. So actually one way to measure it would be to actually look at the energy of the electron coming off, and you can sort of get a sense of what it was. Yeah.
The assumption that light can packets also work with the old equations from when light was a wave.
Well, this was a big part of the problem, right? Because you have all of this theoretical infrastructure that works beautifully, that light is a wave. And now you're talking about light as a packet. And so those are, to us, are conceptually distinct concepts. I mean, even disjoint concepts. I cannot conceive of a packet of water wave at the beach. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. You think of a particle or a packet as having a particular location in space. But where's your wave, right? I mean, it's big. I mean, I can say, yeah, over there's a wave, and I've narrowed it down to meters. But you don't think of it as a packet, really. Yeah.
Yeah, right now, haven't they also shown that light or photons, those packets, have mass?
Not mass, energy. Light particles are massless.
Couldn't they just be moving in a wave, like particles moving in a wave?
Well, there are ways to model it. I mean, you can have local. I mean, I can have a wave on a string and do one little pulse. So you can sort of model that kind of thing, and people do a little bit. But no matter what you do, conceptually, you sort of think of particles and waves as being very different sorts of beasts. And as we're going to find, nature's sort of saying, that's your problem, not mine. I mean, nature's not so confused. But how you model it, how you interpret it, really depends a little bit on what you're trying to measure. You just don't see people talking about refraction of particles or diffraction of particles per se. You do that in the wave framework. So it's how you interpret it depends a little bit on how you're asking the question. Yes?
So energy doesn't have mass?
Yes, energy and mass are different faces of the same thing. But if you're asking about rest mass, or if you're asking, I mean, if you're looking at them as different things, things have mass or they don't. So photons have mass or they don't. If you ask, do photons have energy? Yeah, they do. Does energy have an effect on other things? It does. It can bend space and relativity the way that mass can, in some sense. So there's this deep relationship between energy and mass. I can take a photon and it can convert into massive particles. So there is a deep relationship between them, but I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about all of this as the semester goes on. Yes?
Can like energy be turned into mass?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the... If I have really intense energy here, a lot of photons, they will turn into massive particles. Yes, that certainly happens. Did you... Any other questions right now? All right, so okay. All right, that's probably a good place to stop, which is good because we're out of time, and we're going to come back to this on Monday. So. You too.